The fairway ahead is smooth, green, and very familiar.
This is the perfect temperature for playing golf.
A sunny day with some golfing buddies, and Debbie Dalhoff is in a good place.
I might need a mulligan off this first tee. Oh my gosh. That wasn't good.
Don't need any penalties.
Okay, so sometimes things don't start out so well. You get a bad lie, hit a rough patch. You got to dig yourself out.
But you know what? I'm out here and life is pretty good.
Here, Debbie's thoughts are far away from that night more than three decades ago when a man broke into her home, held her at knife point, raped and tortured her for 3 hours. The crime was never solved. She's still looking for answers. Along with 43 other women, Dalhoff is pursuing class certification to sue the city of Memphis for mishandling their rape cases. Yes, this is the Memphis Rape Kit story. It began unfolding a decade ago, when it was revealed at first that a few hundred kits had not been tested. In the next half hour, we'll explore the real numbers and their impact on women's lives. We'll hear from victims, police, prosecutors. As a warning to listeners, this story contains graphic descriptions of sexual violence. It's a story brought to you by the University of Memphis's Institute for Public Service Reporting. I'm Christopher Blank with WKNO News. Stay with us. So let me have you introduce yourself.
I'm Mark Paraskia. I'm the director of the Institute for Public Service Reporting at the University of Memphis.
Also an investigative journalist.
Yes, for many years.
And so back in 2010, it was a local TV news team that broke this story.
The WREG News Channel 3 On Your Side investigators uncovered that MPD has not found a need to send thousands of rape kits to TBI for testing.
And that is reporter Kelly Raybon. You know, Mark, she learned that hundreds of rape kits were being collected each year, but only something like 6% were being sent off for testing. And this was just the tip of the iceberg.
It came out in fits and starts. I mean, they kept finding things. They didn't realize how many kits they actually had. They stored these kits in so many different locations, 3 or 4 across the city. They had to literally go run them down and find them, and they were finding them in all kinds of nooks and crannies all over the place.
We wanted to take you inside to show you the thousands of untested kits, but the MPD denied our cameras access. In fact, we asked how many untested rape kits are kept behind these doors. They said that's not a number they keep track of.
So, Mark, why weren't they keeping track? I mean, this is evidence.
The police contend that a lot of these kits were not tested because there were legitimate reasons for not testing them. And for example, they would tend to test kits from stranger rapes, sexual assaults involving a stranger, but they contended that there was no need to test kits in many cases where there was an acquaintance rape because the victim already knew who the suspect was. Now, a lot of this was limited thinking of the time. We know now that many of these rapists are actually serial offenders. And so if you test one kit and you upload it into the FBI database, you can link them to other crimes.
So this database, CODIS, the Combined DNA Index System, it sounds to me like the Ancestry.com of law enforcement. But, you know, today genealogy tests are very easy. You send a saliva sample off in the mail. So what's in a rape kit? What is a rape kit?
When somebody is sexually assaulted, they go to the Rape Crisis Center and a forensic examiner will examine the victim.
Combing a victim's body like a crime scene, nurses use a 15-step procedure called a rape kit.
There's usually swabs that are taken, as well as the exam would look for bruising or tears.
Dr. Betty Winter says it's a painful process that can feel like a second assault. But most victims submit to a rape kit's swabs and samples, hoping the evidence will pinpoint a suspect.
It is extremely important to prove that not only who did it, but who didn't do it.
They've been doing these kits in Memphis since probably 1975. in the early days, there was no DNA testing. DNA testing is a more recent phenomenon. You know, back in the mid-90s and earlier, many of these kits were routinely tested for blood type and secretor status, whether a person secretes certain antigens into their blood system. But these kind of tests could exclude a suspect. You could say this person didn't do it, but it couldn't positively identify somebody.
But that's really changed with the technology. And even back in 2002, the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation got access to a huge database of criminal DNA for cross-referencing. And so a rape kit now, even an old rape kit, could still be valuable because of DNA testing.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of unsolved crimes in this city. If you could locate the kit, and they have kits going back that far, you could pull off DNA that in the old days you couldn't and still solve some of these crimes. If it's still in pristine enough condition and hasn't deteriorated or whatnot, and that was another issue that they had as well, you know, that not having things in a climate-controlled, safe environment.
So this is just a hot old warehouse in Fraser.
It was. There was Fraser, where they had kits. There was the basement of 201 Poplar, which is the Criminal Justice Center. There was the Rape Crisis Center, and there was also, there's a jail facility at the old Allen Police Precinct, kind of like, maybe like a scene out of Mayberry, you know, where there's four cells there. And they used that area. They never arrested anybody and put them in those cells, but they put the rape kits in there. And so there are a bunch of them stacked up there too over the years. So these things were just here, there, and everywhere.
So when they added up all these untested rape kits, how many were there?
12,000.
12,000.
12,000.
How does that even compare? Is there any way to measure how big of a mistake that is?
It's been characterized as one of the largest rape kit backlogs in the United States. But we don't know. We don't have all the answers to this day. There's never been a full accounting, in my estimation, from everything I've looked at. There's a lot of unanswered questions about all of that.
Debbie Dolhoff never thought that her rape would be one of those unanswered questions, because for her, the facts are still very clear. It was 2 a.m. She woke up. A man wearing a nylon stocking over his face had a knife at her throat.
He immediately put a pair of my panties in my mouth and gagged me. He tied my hands behind my back. He tied my feet together. And then he tied my hands to my feet, called hog style. He went down the hall and he got my roommate, gagged her, brought her up into my bedroom. And for 3 hours, I was brutally tortured. He was going to cut my breast off, which I knew, because I saw underneath my blindfold again a knife there and a tourniquet hose that he had used to put around it.
Her vivid memories even now exist as an archive of clues. The rapist was methodical. Even that was a clue.
He knew something about DNA. He covered his tracks. He actually vacuumed my house before he left. He took my bed sheets with him.
The cleanup added to her fear that she wouldn't survive the night. But eventually, the man tied Debbie and her roommate together.
He left out the door, and I heard the door close, and I thought, my first thought was, I'm alive. I am alive.
She was alive, and she provided evidence. Evidence that looked similar to three other brutal rapes in the area at the time. 30 years later, all that evidence is missing. Some of it destroyed, rape kits lost, untested. This wasn't the end of her journey, just a new beginning.
I'm over the rapist, but I feel like for 35 years I have been another victim of the city of Memphis.
Mark Paraskia, so far two lawsuits have come from the Memphis rape kit crisis, one state, one federal, both class action representing potentially hundreds of victims. What are they arguing?
The state suit makes a rather novel claim that the city, they negligently inflicted emotional harm on rape victims when they announced this large backlog, if you will, of rape kits that had never been tested for DNA. the federal suit is based upon making a claim under the 14th Amendment to the Constitution that guarantees equal protection under the law. And the argument is that these largely female rape victims have been discriminated against by the police department.
And there are some even within the police department who believe that to be true, or at least some who are now speaking out about past practices.
My name is Cody Wilkerson.
Mark, who is Cody Wilkerson?
Cody Wilkerson was a longtime Memphis police officer. He was there for 26 years.
I'm a retired Memphis police lieutenant.
5 of his last 7 years or so were spent in the Sex Crimes Bureau. He was a detective over there.
Well, Mark, I brought Cody into the studio, and I asked him if he thought there had been negligence at the MPD.
Well, eventually, I started using the term criminally negligent, because in my opinion, that's what the Memphis Police Department was.
So you were there when the untested rape kits were first discovered. What happened next?
You know, the police department didn't like what Donna Nelson at the TBI, the supervisor of the TBI forensic lab, had said, you know. And they started talking about, well, was it a money issue? You know, was the police department not testing these kits because of financial reasons? And Donna Nelson just, you know, told the truth and said, well, I don't know why the police department doesn't bring us all of their rape kits. We don't charge the police department for testing rape kits. So Larry Godwin was a director at the time, and his decision was to, well, if TBI wants all of our rape kits, take all the rape kits out there. And I was the only one saying, shouldn't we try to prioritize which cases ought to go first? Nope, they want them all. We're taking them all.
So now there's this testing backlog, which gives the impression that the TBI is holding things up. But that also means that that current cases can't get tested in a timely manner now.
Taking those 1,500 rape kits to TBI, before that happened, we could submit a rape kit on a current case, and we could get a result back from CODIS in 4 to 6 weeks. But after we took 1,500 rape kits to TBI, it took over a year to get DNA results on a current case.
Well, aren't you getting calls from victims here? You know, what's the status of my case? What's the delay? What's holding things up?
It's very rare for a victim to come up to the office and demand to know what's going on her case. My personal theory on that is, you know, the victims are trying to forget that it ever happened. It's rare for victims to return back to their home if they were raped in their home. And we saw that over and over and over again. We would see that we had these victims who are all over the country because they didn't feel safe here in Memphis, and they didn't want to stay here in Memphis.
But then, you know, you have these victims like Debbie Dolhoff, who have been looking for answers for a long time, and they're finding that their evidence has been destroyed. Did that happen while you were there?
No, I never saw, and I never even heard, I did not hear of any evidence or rape kits being destroyed. Once I returned to sex crimes as a lieutenant, and we're trying to figure out what we've done in the past, going through old documents, you know, I found a log of destroying rape kits. There was just no foresight into what the future held.
In 1995, Lester Ditto was working as a manager of an evidence storage facility used by MPD and the Shelby County Sheriff's Office. They were running out of room. He remembers getting a memo.
The subject is the length of time to keep rape kits, records, and evidence in unsolved, uncharged, and unindicted sex crime cases.
It gave examples of various statutes of limitations. Also, guidance for workers in the property room.
We went back and conducted an inventory.
An inventory of cases with no movement, no progress. Many of them dating back to the 1980s. And then...
I don't remember exactly if we took them to... it seems like we accumulated the ones we could destroy and took them out to the landfill.
More than one landfill, actually, and that's because weeding out old rape kits was a big job.
I don't think I'd be exaggerating to say probably thousands.
If you slow down right where that red truck is, we're going to turn up into a little dead end right there.
Debbie Dolhoff and reporter Mark Parascia are headed to the scene of the crime.
And that was my house right here.
Here?
Right here.
It's a nice house. She and her husband built it. But even all these years later, it's hard to look at.
So what does this, how does this affect you right now?
It hurts to think about what happened in that house.
Is this the first time you've been back, Debbie?
I've driven by once. And what really hurts is to think that he may have lived right there the whole time and could have been caught.
She's talking about the man whom she believes raped her. 7 years ago, when Debbie heard about the MPD rape kit crisis, she decided to investigate her own case. She wanted closure. Even back in 1985, she suspected a man in her neighborhood. He was a firefighter and would have had access to a rubber tourniquet hose used in the assault. And he would have known a little about DNA, why he cleaned up so thoroughly. She eventually got his name. And then there were those other similar yet unsolved rapes in the area. In one case, the victim saw his face. There's a composite drawing that resembles a photo she later found of this same firefighter. Here's Mark Parascia.
All similar. They felt they, you know, this guy was clearly a serial offender who, they said, he knew what he was doing. He would research and study his victims, case them, and then attack.
Do they have rape kits or evidence from these other crimes that they can compare to?
We don't know the answer to that, in part. What we do know is that they couldn't find Debbie's rape kit, and they destroyed her collateral evidence, the bedding and clothing that all could have DNA on it. And when Debbie went recently to talk to Amy Weirich,
who is the district attorney,
and her assistant there, the prosecutor, Abby Wallace, Debbie, with their consent, taped them.
Here. And you have to remember, too, there's two more attacks prior to mine that there could be evidence on.
There's not.
You mean there's no evidence?
It's all been destroyed.
What is the statute of limitations for destroying evidence in an aggravated assault?
That I don't know. I don't know what their policy is. So that would be something
that would all fall under the MPD?
Yeah, there's no statute of limitations on destroying evidence. There's the statute of limitations on being able to arrest somebody and charge them with a crime. But destruction of evidence is policy and procedure of a police department. A good example
policy
of that
and procedure. Is at the heart of these civil lawsuits. For Megan Ebos, who was raped in her home by a stranger when she was just 16, the term rape kit backlog was infuriating to her and other victims.
We felt that it was actually a misleading term and possibly maybe undermining the public understanding of the problem. And as if they had sent the rape kits to overwhelmed labs, which for some reason couldn't test them. When in fact they had not sent the rape kits anywhere, and in many cases they did little other investigative work.
Megan discovered nearly a decade after filing the report that her kit had not been tested. The DNA it finally provided belonged to a man who had raped at least 7 other people. He's now serving a 178-year sentence. Megan is still trying to understand how so many classic stranger rapes, like hers and Debbie's, the kind that all neighborhoods fear, were forgotten.
I mean, the only sense I can make of it is that our public safety institutions are just completely untethered from the idea of public safety.
Megan says that one reform seems obvious, making sex crimes a priority.
When you talk about what a police department is not doing, like not investigating rape, that's not the full picture because it is doing a lot of other things while not investigating rape.
And murder is a big one in a city with a high murder rate. But former MPD sex crimes detective Cody Wilkerson makes this argument.
Homicides are treated differently than any other crime on the police department. That is the most important crime that needs to be investigated. It's the most serious crime that we can handle. And I would argue differently. You know, to me, homicide is not the most important crime. Yes, it's a terrible thing to take somebody's life. And yes, those people need to be caught and held accountable for what they've done. But that victim is no longer suffering. Their suffrage is over. A rape victim, she is going to have to deal with that assault for the rest of her life. And to me, it should be given a higher priority than a homicide is. I'm the only person that feels that way on the Memphis Police Department.
November the 3rd, 1983.
A day Celia Reynolds will never forget. She was walking to work early in the morning because her car was broken. A man grabbed her off the street, pulled her into some woods.
Every single day when I wake up, it's not a day past that I don't think about this.
And it's not just because the rapist was never found, but because when the police showed up, they made assumptions.
When you label me and you don't know me, call me a prostitute, that would hurt. How can you label a person you don't even know them?
She had a rape kit made, but police aren't able to tell her what happened to it.
So therefore, that tells me you didn't do the report like you were supposed to.
Her story is not uncommon.
I was lied to from the very beginning about it being tested for DNA.
That's Terry Burks, raped by a trio of men in 1988. Like many, she hoped that the discovery of the kits would help bring people to justice. Instead, the process has only led to more questions.
How long has this been going on? How many women have gone through this and it hasn't made a difference?
In her own investigation, Debbie Dahlhoff found disturbing contradictions in official documents. One report said that Debbie's roommate, who was also raped and tortured, no longer wanted to be contacted by investigators.
Absolute lie.
That is Jan Benet Carroll.
Nobody has ever contacted me, and if they would have called and asked me, I would have been involved as I am now, and the first thing I would have done was hung up that phone and called my roommate, Debbie Dahlhoff, and told them that they called.
So, Mark Perskia, the rape kit situation was 30-plus years in the making. Well, people in government today are now having to answer for these failures. So how are officials doing so far?
Well, they are very aggressively pursuing the cold case prosecutions. Arguably, it's remedial work because, I mean, it was things that should have been investigated and prosecuted years ago. MPD claims they've righted their ship. However, they've been far less than transparent in my dealings with them. And the thing that they've held up is that we can't do any interviews because of these lawsuits that are hanging over us. So it's kind of put this squelch on information. But they contend that caseloads are down, that in the adult crime sections of the Sex Bureau, they have more officers, by what they're saying now, detectives investigating cases, that they're getting more training, and that they are working more closely to do true victim-centered investigations with the Rape Crisis Center. Now, they are just giving like written responses to questions. So, I mean, hopefully that they really have righted their ship.
And back to the prosecution side, there have been a number of solved cases and quite a few convictions. Here's Shelby County District Attorney Amy Wyrick.
So we've got 22 serial rapists that we've identified so far. And these are individuals who have raped three or more citizens of our community. But 22 of them to date, and 9 of those 22 have already been convicted on some or all of their cases, and they're gone away to prison for basically the rest of their lives.
You know, arguably, they've done a tremendous amount of work. They've indicted more than 300 defendants and DNA profiles in many cases on John Doe's people they have not yet identified as individuals.
Right. And what you're talking about is this legal tool that prosecutors have now, where if they can't find a person to match the DNA, they indict the DNA itself because it's unique to each individual, and then they wait for a match.
And then if it's enough information to then eventually learn their identity so that you can put handcuffs on them, issue a warrant, and bring them into justice, that's really all that has to happen.
And this rape kit crisis also led to some law reform. One example, the state of Tennessee abolished the statute of limitations for certain types of aggravated rape cases. And that was partly because so many people over the last 2 and 3 decades never got justice. And also, the DNA matches were showing that many stranger rapes are not isolated events. These are serial offenders.
One officer told me, he says, it's just a mindset. You mean, it isn't that you just decide to rape somebody someday, that there's kind of a mindset of a rapist. And so they have caught 22 of them that they've been able to identify.
Are those seagulls up there?
I couldn't tell if they were seagulls the last time. I was hoping to see seagulls, but there were a lot of vultures. And
yes,
like
vultures.
Small
I would
lapers.
Say vultures.
Yes.
The birds can pluck whatever they want from the South Shelby landfill. It's a mountain of garbage, 200 feet high. But when Mark, Megan Ebos, and Debbie Dahlhoff visit the last known location of so much rape evidence, the only thing it offers them is a bleak perspective.
My hurt for 35 years is out here in a dump site. My pain is in a dump site. My feelings is in a dump site. Because they didn't do what they were supposed to do.
For all the victims who feel as if they were thrown away by law enforcement, this place is their mountaintop.
And they have no idea the pain that you go through in something like this. They have no idea.
Maybe they do, though, and that's even more disturbing.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
In the 6 years since Debbie identified the man she believes raped her, then waited for police to search warehouses and logs for any scrap of DNA, her suspect died, a free man until the end. She's still demanding closure. She wants to know she was right. She also wants MPD to admit they were wrong.
I want an apology that goes out publicly.
She hopes that someday she can put that mountain behind her for good, which is why maybe her heart has found a greener landscape. Here, on the golf course. The way forward is gentle, the hazards are known, and she is in control.
Oh! Oh! Birdie, first hole!
At least sometimes.
Great putt, Deb.
Thank you.
And at the end of the day, there's no mystery over who has her back.
This is my safe place. So these guys are absolutely, they mean everything to me. I don't think there's one of them out here. Chuck, what do you think?
I don't think
there's one guy here that are in my little family that I couldn't call and they'd be right there.
Oh, yeah. Favor anytime you need it.
Yep. They take care of me. That's for sure.
And for Debbie Dahlhoff and the other victims of the Memphis rape kit crisis, that should not be too much to ask from law enforcement. This special report is a collaboration between the University of Memphis's Institute for Public Service Reporting and WKNO News. It's based on investigative research by Mark Parascia and was produced by me, Christopher Blank. Music for this program is by Memphis musicians Jonathan Kirksey and Robbie Grant. This album, Duets for Mellotron, and more is at mellotronvariations.com. Special thanks to Bruce Moore of WREG and Karen Pulfer Folk. A link to her photography, along with more about this story, can be found at WKNOFM.org.